So practically what this means, and also as you talk about children facing hunger, of course, adults too, what are the long-term effects of this?
Yeah, I think three parts of it. The UNICEF and the United Nations absolutely stands by that data and the robustness of that data. It is the Secretary General's report, and I would have to leave it to their office to speak more to it. But yes, we do, and we have for many months called this a war on children. And like everything here, we do that based on evidence. We don't do that seeking a headline. We do that because of all the conflicts where UNICEF operates, through all the front lines, from Afghanistan to Yemen to Ukraine to Syria, we have not seen the percentage of civilians injured, maimed, killed as high as on children as here. That's why the evidence speaks to this being a war on children. And yes, that is because there's a large child population and it's a dense population. It's also because we have continuously seen an indiscriminate nature of bombings. On Tuesday, when I was at Al-Aqsa Hospital in the middle area, how many families I speak to, and again, sometimes, Amy, I go into a hospital and literally, right, I'm going to talk to the first person I see, and there are thousands of people. There are children on the floor needing attention despite the best, brave, selfless efforts of doctors working 24 hours a day who at the same time are thinking, how do I get wood and water to my family tonight? First family I saw was a little boy, Ali. Ali was asleep in the third floor of his family home when a missile struck. Next thing, he's in the rubble on the ground floor. I then learned that Ali's mother was also in that bombing, that attack on the family home. I found her in the hospital, and I wanted to explain that I'd found Ali and so on. I thought I actually had good news for a millisecond. I thought in this darkness I had something to share. In fact, she was aware that Ali was there, but she also explained that her two other children had been killed in that bomb attack. These are ongoing. Yeah, last night, tonight. So that's the indiscriminate nature of this war that continues. It continues. Of a nutritional crisis, I'm sorry, you have to repeat that last part of your question.
The effects, the long-term effects of hunger on children.
Yeah, unfortunately, UNICEF has learned this because we operate north to south, south to east, on the east to west, rather, around the world. They are many, and they worsen, just like trauma worsens nutritional status of a child. If the longer it is left unattended, the worse it gets. And in the youngest children, obviously the greatest risk is death, and a severely malnourished child is 10 times more likely to die from a common illness. And my goodness, there are common illnesses here because of the deprivation of sanitation and water. But there are also risks to mental development. There are great risks to physical growth and psychological growth, mental development. Now, that impact long-term is on the society, is on their community, is on their income potential. All right, and that may sound like a long way off. It shouldn't be. UNICEF is always looking at the whole age bracket of a child. And if we look here in Gaza, this young child population, any economist, any demographer will tell you, you get this right with a young child population. And it's not hard. You have the right training, the right skills, the right opportunity, and you have a demographic boom. You have the envy of aging populations. You get it wrong, and you have all the attendant risks of security and everything else that goes with it. And this is a paradigm example of getting it wrong.
Finally, James Elder, going back to that issue of a ceasefire, what exactly that would mean?
It means everything, Amy. It means everything. There's times my own voice that I've heard myself and feel tired saying it, much less what people must think. But when you're in Gaza and you still feel that hope among people, the number of women, I was with a meeting a man just earlier near the water, and he explained, he has moved eight times he's moved. And he's well versed on all the Security Council resolutions in this current one. And his words to me were, we must continue to hope, but this feels like our last hope. And I understand that the decay of the psychological state, people are just holding on. I've had many women say to me words to the effect of, well, my husband's been killed, my home was destroyed, I've lost the ability to feed my children, and I've lost my job. All I have left is hope. So they are holding on to hope, but they're also aware that some of them have lost count of how many of these resolutions there are. But a ceasefire means, in the most simple sense, hostages go home. That torment ends. It means a mother will promise her child, as a mother said to me, exactly these words, I will be able to go to bed that night with my child and promise her she can wake up. You can't do that here. As many people have said to me, living or dying is luck. It is luck here, given the indiscriminate nature. So a ceasefire for those with the power, the military aims, whatever they are, have created this war on children. Those with the power on this ceasefire, they need, as I say, they need to understand the suffering here. And as many Gazans are saying, this does feel like their last hope.
James Elder, UNICEF spokesperson. UNICEF is the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund, joining us from Rafah, Gaza. Next up, former President Trump just met with top Republicans at the Capitol for the first time since January 6. We'll get response from Democratic Congressmember Jamie Raskin, who served on the Select Committee to investigate the January 6 attack. We'll also talk about the Supreme Court, and we'll talk about Gaza. Stay with us.
Keep your key. You're gonna need it to come back home. I'm always free. I'm here to remind you you're never alone. And it's hard to say that I've been okay. Every now and then I hear you call. You're gonna need it to come back home. Keep your key. You will find a place in me. From all.
Keep your key by El Noor. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump hit the campaign trail in the battleground state of Michigan Saturday to address black voters in Detroit. He also attended a conference of the right-wing Get Out the Vote group Turning Point USA.
First day in office, we're going to close up the border. First day in office, we're going to drill, baby, drill.
This comes after Trump returned to the U.S. Capitol Thursday for the first time since the January 6, 2021 insurrection. Trump met with Republican lawmakers, including House Speaker Mike Johnson, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and Senator Mitt Romney. Politico reports Trump asked Johnson for help to overturn his conviction of 34 felonies in New York and to help punish the Justice Department. Our next guest has called Republican leaders' meetings with Trump a scandal and a disgrace. Yes, that's Democratic Congressmember Jamie Raskin, who served on the Select Committee to investigate the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol and was the lead impeachment manager in the second impeachment trial of former President Trump. He's the author of Unthinkable: Trauma, Truth, and the Trials of American Democracy. Congressmember Raskin, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Why don't you just talk about the significance of that meeting that might have gone under the radar for some, what it meant for Trump to return to the Capitol, and the lining up of his even previous critics behind him.
Well, Amy, thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure to be back with you on your show. For Trump, I imagine he experienced it as a triumphant moment. He was last seen in disgrace and infamy after he incited a violent insurrection against the union to surround and prop up his inside political coup, where he tried to get Vice President Pence to step outside of his constitutional role and simply declare Trump the victor in a presidential election that Trump lost by more than 7 million votes, 306 to 232 in the Electoral College. But his return to Capitol Hill showed that he has cemented his political stranglehold over the Republican Party. And members of Congress who had criticized him, some of whom even seemed to have made a permanent break with him, like Lindsey Graham after the insurrection, are now completely back in the fold. And we see the way that Donald Trump operates, much as J.D. Vance once described it back when he was not in the cult. As a form of cultural and political heroin, they're acting like addicts and they are acting like cult members, which make the stakes of this election awfully clear for everybody else.
Oh, you mentioned J.D. Vance, top contender for vice presidential running mate of President Trump. Also, the return to the Capitol. I mean, so many of the insurrectionists who've been arrested, who've been jailed, are not allowed to return there, but President Trump is.
Well, Trump is busy pardoning everybody he can. I mean, he pardoned before he left office Michael Flynn, Roger Stone, Paul Manafort, Dinesh D'Souza, Steve Bannon, Joe Arpaio. These people are the inner coterie of his political campaign in 2024. And now he's promising to pardon hundreds of shock troops on the extreme right, people from the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and other extremist groups who attacked Capitol officers, Metropolitan Police Department officers, officers from Montgomery County, Maryland, the jurisdiction I represent in Congress. And these are people who violently assaulted officers and deliberately tried to stop the steal, which means to interfere with the counting of Electoral College votes and to accomplish the peaceful transfer of power. He is running around the country saying he's going to pardon these, quote, political prisoners or hostages. A hostage, of course, is someone who's been illegally abducted by a terrorist group like Hamas or a criminal group, and then held for a financial or a political ransom. And he is treating people who are violent lawbreakers and insurrectionists, seditionists to the American Republic as hostages or political prisoners. And so, again, he continues to set himself at war against our constitutional order.
Can you explain his request to the House Speaker Johnson about trying to go after the Justice Department to reverse the guilty verdict for the 34 felonies he was found guilty of here in New York?
Yeah, well, I don't know if Donald Trump actually understands the difference between the federal system and the state system. They have been roundly denouncing the Department of Justice, which is a huge irony, given that it's the Department of Justice that just prosecuted and succeeded in convicting Hunter Biden on his gun charges and is busy prosecuting a U.S. senator who's a Democrat from New Jersey and a Democratic representative from Texas on various charges. But in any event, you know, when, you know, Donald Trump's like a dog with a bone, and now he can't stand the fact that he's a loser and has been pronounced guilty 34 different times by a jury of his peers in New York. And so all hands on deck to try to reverse his convictions. And of course, Speaker Johnson, who declares himself to be a fundamentalist Christian and someone devout and who elevates the Bible above all else, has pledged to help Donald Trump absolve himself of these charges of cooking the books financially in order to cover up his $130,000 in hush money payments to his porn star erstwhile mistress. And disturbingly, Johnson said that he knows members of the Supreme Court and he knows how upset they are. And given that we're finally getting some real information about how the right wing of the court operates, I don't doubt him for one moment that he's been in touch with people like Alito and Thomas, and they are trying to figure out a way to reverse Donald Trump's conviction. So while they're attacking the rule of law and they're attacking the jury system, in fact, they're doing everything they can to compromise the judiciary and to destroy the rule of law in our country.
So you mentioned Alito and Thomas. In Supreme Court news, of course, Justice Clarence Thomas has finally acknowledged taking more free vacations paid for by the billionaire right-wing mega-donor Harlan Crow. In a filing Friday, Thomas disclosed he accepted two trips in 2019, one to Indonesia, another to the Bohemian Grove in California. Last year, ProPublica revealed Thomas had failed to disclose at least 38 luxury trips gifted by Crow and three other right-wing billionaires dating back decades. This comes as the wife of Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito faced criticism over an upside-down flag reportedly flown at the Alito home in 2021. I mean, it was the Alito's home, Justice Samuel Alito, in Virginia and in New Jersey. Both the upside-down flag that was flown at the insurrection in 2021 and also the appeal to heaven flag. It was Alito who blamed his wife. But apparently these flags had flown for a long time. What's the significance of this? You're a constitutional lawyer. What do you think should happen? And the fact that the Senate Judiciary Committee has subpoena power, what should they be doing? ProPublica won the Pulitzer Prize for their exposing of what's been going on with these justices. But what about the Senate Judiciary Committee?
Well, the first thing we have to observe, Amy, is that the ethics disclosure system, such as it is on the Supreme Court, doesn't work. It is only through this expert outside agitation by ProPublica and other groups that we're finally getting to the truth. But obviously, they don't have a meaningful ethics disclosure reporting system on the Supreme Court. The highest court in the land has the lowest ethical standards. It's the only court in the land where the judges or the justices have literally no mechanism where people can go to complain meaningfully about there being ethics violations. The second thing is that the laws and the rules that apply are essentially non-existent. Now, on Capitol Hill, a member of Congress is limited to $50 in terms of what we can accept from somebody who wants to take us out for lunch or dinner or offer us a gift. Most of the members that I know just don't take anything because they don't even want to go down that road and try to estimate what's worth $30 or $40 or $60 or what have you. Meantime, you've got Clarence Thomas accepting millions of dollars in gifts. In what world does that make any sense? How is that a gift as opposed to a payment or perhaps a bribe? And how is that a definition of friendship? I mean, you know, I've gone on trips with lots of my friends, but we go together. It's not like they pay for me hundreds of thousands of dollars to go somewhere else. So people have got to use some common sense about what's going on here. And that private corruption is an exact correlate to the public corruption that's taking place. They fly the American flag upside down. They fly the flag of the National Rifle Association right side up, and they hoist it way above the American flag. And we just saw that in the bump stock case, which is going to lead to some severely harmful consequences in the cities and towns and streets of America, as Justice Sotomayor warned. I mean, the whole reason that bump stocks and semi-automatic weapons, when put together, are treated or were treated like machine guns until the right wing of the court got involved is because of what we saw happen in Las Vegas, the most deadly massacre in American history, with 58 people murdered and more than 500 wounded and more than 1,000 rounds that were shot in 11 minutes. I mean, that's pretty extraordinary. And yet, Justice Thomas, with all of his little pictorial illustrations borrowed from right-wing sources, sets out to prove that, no, a machine gun, you just press the trigger once, but in the bump stock arrangement, you have to maintain some pressure on it. And that's why they overturned that regulation.
I want to ask you about another issue. This just broke this morning. The governor of Maryland planning today to pardon 175,000 marijuana convictions, wipe the records clean. The sweeping move by Governor Moore is expected to help about 100,000 people who are arrested on low-level drug charges. He said he's ecstatic that we have a real opportunity with what he said I'm signing to right a lot of historical wrongs, timing it with this week's Juneteenth festival. federal holiday, June 19th, to mark the end of slavery in the United States. We're speaking to you. Congressmember Raskin, at your home in Tacoma Park, Maryland, you represent Maryland. Do you support what Governor Moore is doing?
Very much so. I'm extremely proud of our great governor, Wes Moore, for what he's doing and timing it with Juneteenth. It will undoubtedly be an emancipation in the lives of people who have to deal with all of the legal and social disabilities imposed by marijuana prohibition. And that's what this is all about. I mean, we've got an anti-prohibition principle in our Constitution. Prohibition did not work. That doesn't mean that alcohol and, you know, liquor use is great for everybody. But the way to get over an alcohol addiction is through the 12-step programs and challenging yourself to get over it, not throwing people in jail and building up organized crime and the mafia in America, which is what prohibition did. And it's the same thing with marijuana prohibition. Obviously, it didn't work. Millions of people, including lots of politicians and presidents, have admitted to using marijuana. And so why would we use marijuana as an opportunity to paste a lifelong disability on people's ability to, you know, go to college, to get jobs and so on? And so I'm proud of what Governor Moore is doing at the same time that we take seriously the public health consequences of any kind of addiction. It's a serious thing.
If you can comment today, switching gears to Gaza. Yesterday, Congressmember Ro Khanna, your colleague from California, said he will not attend Prime Minister Netanyahu's joint address to Congress in July. He's joining people like Senator Bernie Sanders and others. Are you going to be joining them, Congressmember Raskin?
Well, I haven't figured that out yet. You know, my main commitment at this point is to see a ceasefire, to end the bloodshed, to get the hostages returned, and to surge humanitarian aid into Gaza. And our focus has to be on that. I'm not even necessarily convinced that Netanyahu is coming. And I want us to keep the focus on ending the violence right now.
What do you mean, do you mean, Congressman Raskin, that you're not convinced he's coming?
Well, originally there was another date given. That date was changed. Now the date that has been given, I think, is July 24th. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, there is a war going on, and I hope there's a meaningful ceasefire process that's taking place. And I think we should keep our focus on that. And you know, and then obviously I'll have to confront the whole question of whether, you know, I can assist some tiny forward momentum in terms of making peace and bringing an end to the bloodshed by going or by not going. I don't know the answer to that, but that's the kind of calculus I would have to make.
Congressmember Raskin, are you for a permanent ceasefire?
Well, I'm for a permanent cessation of all military hostilities. We've got to end these brutal cycles of violence and warfare. And that means we've got to address the underlying political problems. And we need to get onto the path to a real two-state solution, which has been American policy and also the international consensus for decades.
Congressman Raskin, also Bernie Sanders, the independent senator, has called for a cutoff of military aid. Who in support of that?
I have not called for a cutoff of all military aid to Israel. I did vote against the last package because of the way that this war has been prosecuted. And I said from the beginning that Israel has a right to defend itself against the kinds of terrorist atrocities that we saw take place on October 7th, but only within the constraints of international law and international human rights law. And if you step outside of it, then that is a disaster for humanity.
Finally, President Biden's, neck and neck with President Trump and running for president. There have been these uncommitted votes all over the country where people are saying they don't support President Trump, but they don't support President Biden because of his support for Netanyahu and Israel's war on Gaza. I'm wondering your thoughts as young people overwhelmingly have fled the Democrats when it comes to voting for Biden right now. African-Americans, you know, 1,000 religious leaders, black leaders wrote to President Biden and said they've never seen anything like this since the civil rights movement. Whole congregations criticizing President Biden for how he has supported Netanyahu in this war on Gaza. Your thoughts?
Well, look, I mean, we're living in a time of extraordinary fanaticism and illegality and threat to democracy and human rights. And we're obviously confronting that in America with the return of Donald Trump and his authoritarian movement, which traffics in racism, anti-Semitism, you name it. I believe that the Democratic Party must be on the side of the Constitution and the rule of law. And that includes international law and international human rights law, the laws of war. And I believe that's where the vast majority of the people are. And I believe that the Biden administration is honestly and aggressively working for a ceasefire and for a return of the hostages that are being held by Hamas right now. And I think that's where most people are. I think that people do not support a war that has resulted in lots of civilian casualties, a majority of them being women and children, and people do not support the terrorism of Hamas. People support the strategic defense and security of Israel, and people want to see progress out of the nightmare, which has been going on for decades now, these cycles of terror and war that leave lots of casualties, lots of death on both sides, and lots of hopelessness. And we know that Donald Trump offers absolutely no hope for progress there. And I believe that the Biden administration and the Democrats will be the way for us to get through this nightmare and to get to a ceasefire and then meaningful negotiations so we can break out of this. And in addition to the humanitarian imperative, which is so overwhelming on both sides, this war has also been an environmental nightmare. I mean, the world can't afford more wars like this. We have got to get people together across the world to be dealing with the reality of climate change, which is now a dagger at the throat of all humanity.
Jamie Raskin, we want to thank you for being with us, a Democrat representing Maryland's 8th Congressional District in the House of Representatives, author of the book Unthinkable. This is Democracy Now! Back in 20 seconds. Pavan Guru Pani Pita Mata Tarita Mahata Dis Rat Dui Dai Daya Khele Sagal Jagata Khele Sajagata by Brooklyn-based musician Sunny Singh. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Acclaimed author Arundhati Roy could soon face trial under India's contested anti-terror laws after an official from Prime Minister Narendra Modi's far-right BJP party gave the go-ahead for her prosecution. The charges against Roy stem from comments she made about Kashmir in 2010. Free speech advocates have expressed outrage over the persecution of Arundhati Roy, as well as other critics of Modi, who was sworn in last week to his third term as prime minister, albeit with BJP having lost its parliamentary majority in a stunning defeat. For more, we're joined by the award-winning Indian author and journalist Siddharth Deb. Welcome back to Democracy Now! We only have a few minutes. It may shock a lot of people who have followed Arundhati over the years, the remarkable award-winning author. Explain what she faces.
Well, she's been, this case is so convoluted, it's hard to say where it begins, where it ends, and that's the point. The process is the punishment. It's for a seminar that she took part in 2010. A right-wing sort of person lodged charges with the police. Most of them, some of them have expired. But this one, the lieutenant governor of Delhi, who is very much a Modi man, has announced in the media that they're going to allow